So thank you all very much for having me here. Thanks to Corey for organizing this series of talks. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how to derive certain macroscopic physical laws from microscopic physical laws, or more concretely, how to derive laws from classical physics, laws of classical physics from laws from quantum physics. I actually had pretty big plans for that and started preparing, and so this was like what I had in mind. But I'll actually have to keep it to pretty basic things because I'm not quite sure how much physical background all of you have. So let me just start and let's see how far we get. So let me start with classical mechanics. So Isaac Newton, in 1687, formulated the laws of motion for macroscopic objects. And so this was in his book, Principia. Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica. And in his formulation of the laws that govern the dynamics of classical objects, there are the three following points. First of all, there is inertial motion. And this point addresses the following fact. If you consider an object at position x of t, at time t, at position x, so this is the position, and assuming that the object has mass m, then the momentum of that object, p is m times the velocity, okay, is a conserved quantity, meaning that it does not change in time. If there are no outside influences acting on this object, on this particle, so if it is left by itself. Now, if there are outside influences on this particle, then this is going to change the momentum. And the momentum change is connected to an action of a force on the object. So a change in time, so the dot denotes derivative in time, of the momentum is due to an action of a force at the position where the object is located. Right? And that's the second part, which addresses when inertial motion is disturbed. And the third part tells you that whenever there is a force acting on a system, then the action that experiences the negative of that force. Right? So the sum of forces has to be zero over system boundaries. So this is action is equal to reaction. Okay? And based on these three principles, what we understand as classical mechanics was initiated. Now, if you look at this equation here, if you assume in particular a special case that the force is actually the gradient of a function, okay, so it's a gradient vector field, then the equation here, Newton's equation here, has the following form. So m times, so the p derivative is m times x, two derivatives, is gradient u. And now you can multiply this from both sides. You can take the inner product or scalar product with the velocity. And you see that this is a total derivative of m times x dot square 1/2, and this is the total derivative of u. Okay? And actually, I should put here a negative sign. And of course, then you can integrate this in time, and you find that 1/2 m x dot square in t minus 1/2 m x dot at time 0 is equal to u, negative u, at x of t minus minus u at x of 0. Or if you put whatever depends on t on the same side, then you have m x dot square of t plus u of x of t is the corresponding expression at time 0. Now, so meaning that this quantity here is conserved along the trajectories of particles which undergo this force. And the quantity here is called the energy, and the energy is conserved. Okay, so now the question is, how do we understand actually that, maybe from a higher principle, why Newton's equations have this form? Now, to understand this in a slightly more sophisticated level, so let me call this here T. This is the kinetic energy. The kinetic energy arises from the fact that the particle is in, or the object is in motion. So only when the particle is in, or I will talk about objects as particles from now on, is in motion, then the velocity is non-zero, right? While here, this quantity is called the potential energy. Now you can introduce the following quantity, L, which is a function of, say, x of t, or x as a function of t, which is given by the kinetic energy minus the potential energy. Now, the quantity which is conserved is kinetic plus potential energy, but now I'm writing down kinetic minus potential energy. This is called the Lagrange function, or Lagrangian. And you can introduce the following quantity. You can look at S, which depends on x as a function of t. So this is a functional. It maps a function to a number. Okay? And you take initial time, say t naught, and end time t, and you take the Lagrangian. Now, you see the t here actually depends on x dot, and the u depends on x. So actually I should say that depends on x and x dot. Okay? So you take L, which depends on x and x dot, and integrate in time. Now, maybe let me call the time variable here tau, because t is the end time. And so what does this say? It says that you can look at a position at t naught, and you can look at a position at time t, and you can connect the two points with a path given by x of tau. And at every point x of tau, you can determine the tangent vector. That's x dot of tau. Now you can take these two data and put this into the Lagrangian, and then you integrate along the given path. Okay? The quantity that you get here is called the classical action. And the dimension of the classical action is energy, so this is energy, times time. So the dimension is energy, or the unit is energy times time. Okay? Now, so this is the action. Now you may ask, well, you know, this action depends, of course, on how I pick this connecting path. Now, what will make this action bigger or smaller? Well, that's a good question to ask. Now, there is the following result. Among all the paths that connect these two points, the same two points, the one that minimizes the action satisfies the Newtonian equations. So Newton's equations correspond to the minimizing paths of the action function. Now, this expressed in the following way. You compare all possible paths connecting the two points, and you ask, well, how do you minimize this? Well, you can just compare S of just x plus delta x, so that's you consider a path like this one here, and then you consider a nearby path, and then between two points on the two paths, you consider the connecting vector, which is a small vector, right? And you subtract S of x, and then you want to have this correspond to a minimum, so you ask that 1 over dx. I mean, this is just very, I mean, this is not precise, but very, very formally, you want that when this, when delta x in a certain norm goes to 0, that this goes to 0. This is minimization of the action, but you are not differentiating with respect to a variable, you are differentiating with respect to a path. Okay? So when this goes to 0, then this implies that the L has to satisfy a certain condition, and the condition looks like this. The L partial derivative in x dot time derivative minus L partial derivative in x has to be 0. This is the Euler-Lagrange equation for the minimization of this action. Okay? Euler-Lagrange. Okay, and if you take this expression here, the kinetic minus the potential energy, plug it in here. Well, only the kinetic energy depends on x dot, and you get m times derivative of this in time is x double dot times x dot. No, I'm sorry. The derivative of the kinetic energy in x dot is just m times x dot, and then you take a time derivative, you get m x dot dot. Okay, and then minus dl dx, so only the u depends on x, so you have minus minus. X derivative of u, this is 0, these are Newton's equations. Okay, so this is the so-called Lagrangian picture of classical mechanics. And there is still another way to look at classical mechanics in the following manner. So as I said here, the energy here is conserved. And the momentum is given here. Right? So now, of course, you could solve the x dot with respect to p. And you can re-express the energy in terms of x and p. So you can introduce, well, what is x dot in terms of p? Well, it's p divided by m, you square it and multiply by m, so you get p square divided by m, 2m, plus u of x. That's the expression for the energy in terms of p and x. And this is called h of x and p, the Hamiltonian of the system. Okay? And the equations of motion due to Newton, then have the following form. So P is x dot times m. So x dot is P divided by m, right? But P divided by m, you see, you obtain by taking the partial derivative of h with respect to P. So this is dh dp. And P dot is the derivative is negative gradient u, or this, I mean, gradient u in my notation is the same as partial derivative in x of u. So p dot is minus partial derivative of u in x, right? Because this is m times x double dot. And you see that this is minus dh dx, because this is u is the only term in h that depends on x. Okay, or you can write this more compactly as x p dot is a matrix 0, 1, minus 1, 0, gradient of gradient of h in x and p. Okay? So these are the so-called Hamiltonian equations of motion. And the matrix here is the so-called symplectic base matrix. Now, in the given situation, I have looked at x and p as a vector where x is in, say, three-dimensional space, and then p is also in three-dimensional space. If you are in n-dimensional space, then this would be a vector in R2n. Okay. However, you could generalize this to actually a manifold replacing the R2n. And this would lead you to symplectic geometry. This is how that field started with classical mechanics. Now, the space of pairs x and p, let me call this m, is called the phase space. Okay? So these are some basics about classical mechanics. And there is one more thing that I should say. Which is, now, the Hamiltonian equations of motions, that's an ODE, that's an ordinary differential equation. So you have the differential equation, then in addition you have to specify the initial data. So you have to tell the initial position and initial momentum. Right? And then in phase space, the solution to the equation there would be x of t is phi t evaluated on the initial data. Right? This is the map that takes your initial data to the solution at time t. The phi here is called the Hamiltonian flow. Now, if you look at the Hamiltonian equations in this way, then of course per initial data you ask what is the corresponding orbit in phase space under the Hamiltonian flow. But on the other hand, you might actually not be interested in one orbit. You might ask about, well, if I just look at the neighborhood of orbits, how does that flow? How does that volume flow? Right? So instead of looking at individual orbits, so in phase space, that's M, you might look at, you know, some say maybe an indicator function which is supported here, or you may look at a probability distribution mu which has its support here, which satisfies that it is a probability, defines a probability measure. So this is 1, and this here is non-negative. Okay, and you may ask, well, if I randomize the question, if I don't look at an individual initial data, but I look at initial data in here, well, how does that flow in time? Right? So, well, how does that flow in time? Well, every point here in the support is just transported along the using the Hamiltonian flow. So the entire object here is just flown like that. And what this is telling you is that the equation of motion for the mu t here has to be as follows. So the mu t evaluated at x and p, so if this here is x and p in phase space, has to have the value of mu at time 0 at this point here. And what is this point here? This point here is the initial data to which this point here belongs. So this is the negative time flow with the Hamiltonian flow. So the Hamiltonian flow with applied with negative t of x and p. This is the pre-match of x and p under the Hamiltonian. Okay? So this is mu naught of phi negative t of x and p. And now if you want to determine what is the differential equation that is satisfied here, then, well, why don't you just take a time derivative of this? And, well, how do you deal with this? Well, this has two components, an x component and a p component. You have to take the corresponding partial derivatives. So the x component, mu naught of what comes here. And then you have to take the time derivative in x dot. And you have to take the p partial derivative and take p dot, right? Using the chain rule. And now you can remember that this and this, you know exactly what form they have. This just comes from star. The x dot and the p dot satisfy the Hamiltonian equations. You can just plug that in. So what is this? This is a gradient partial p h dx mu. Now I just plug in the mu t into the minus gradient x h gradient p mu t. Okay? And I could put this to the other side and write here 0. And if you've seen fluid equations in maybe a PDE course, then you recognize that this here corresponds to a transport equation. Okay, it describes a fluid. So this is a transport equation. So the dp of h is nothing else but p divided by m. And the equation here is called the Liouville equation in classical mechanics. So it describes how a probability measure is known using the Hamiltonian. Okay? Now I'm saying this, all of this about classical mechanics, because all of this is going to show up in a different way in quantum mechanics. So this is basically, these are basically some of the cornerstones, the most important elementary facts about about classical mechanics. Now, quantum mechanics became necessary when, towards the end of the 19th century, physical experiments became more and more powerful, and when physicists actually were probing the verification of the so-called atomistic hypothesis. Because by that time, the hypothesis that all matter is with a few different kinds of elementary particles. That was absolutely not clear at that time. And a breakthrough was reached in 1897 when J.J. Thomson experimentally verified that the electron exists, so that there exists an entity called the electron. The theoretical idea that electrons might exist, so this was experimentally verified. The theoretical thesis that there are electrons are due to Stoney in 1894. And I might, I mean, maybe it's interesting that the following also is true. There is a certain Mrs. Geraldine Tully, who, from the U.S., who is currently the oldest person alive. And she was born on May 23rd, 1899. So that was 2 years after the first person reached the insights that actually electrons do exist. And so within one lifetime, she got to see, almost see, the discovery of the electron to the iPhone 6 Plus. That's just one lifetime. Okay. So, the problem with classical mechanics was that classical mechanics was not able to explain why matter is stable, why matter does not collapse. Now, so there was a lot of confusion about matter being of particle, of type of particles or waves, of course you know that. And it was in 1905 that Einstein actually postulated that in order to be able to explain some of the physical observations getting attention at the time, that it was necessary to interpret light not as being of waveform but of particle form. So light, I mean, it was a big achievement due to Maxwell to understand that light is actually understandable as waves. That was back in 1865 when he discovered the Maxwell equation. But Einstein, in 1905, postulated that light has to consist of particles, and the particles have energy h times nu. So nu is the frequency of the light particle, and h is the Gauss, Planck constant, h. 6.62 times 10 to the minus 34 joule second. This is the Planck constant. And, okay, so that was a very, a new thing at the time. And what is interesting, particularly interesting perhaps, is that the Planck constant has the physical units of the classical action. So units of the action S. Okay? So that's energy times time. And so now that Einstein had discovered that light has to consist of particles, I mean, there were other kinds of matter which had been understood as being of particle type, such as the electron. But that also ran into problems, and De Broglie in 1924 postulated that in order to reach consistency of physical observations, that matter has to be of waveform. Okay? And now, if you take a light particle, which is called a photon, then its momentum is h bar is h divided by 2 pi times k. K is the wave vector. So what this is saying is that k absolute value is the frequency, and the direction is the direction which the wave is going. Okay? Now, what De Broglie said was that, well, all matter is wave-like, and including an electron. And if you look at an electron as a wave, which has a, it must have a wave vector, and if it has a wave vector k, then its momentum must be h bar times k, just as is the case with light. Okay? And, well, how do you describe waves? Well, typically you look at plane waves, and these are functions exponential I, k, x, right? This is a plane wave. Now, in 1925, G.P. Thompson, which is the son of J.J. Thompson, verified experimentally that the electron has wave nature. Okay, so his father verified that the electron has particle nature, and he verified that the electron has wave nature. Him and then also Davison and Germer. Okay. So now, if the momentum of an electron is h bar times k times its wave vector, then the energy of an electron should be m halves times the momentum square, which is m halves times h bar square k square. Right?
I'm sorry.
1 p square of 2 m 1 over 2 m. All right. Now, if you look at the plane wave function, if you assume that the plane wave somehow describes the electron, then you might ask, well, how do you extract this information from that? And, well, it's quite obvious. What you have to do is you have to take minus I h bar gradient, and if you apply that to the wave, to the plane wave, then you get h bar times k times e to the I kx, right? So here you have a differential operator which acts on this function, and you obtain a relationship between it and the function that is of the following type. Well, it is an eigen value. This is not a value, but this is an eigenvalue for this operator with this eigenvector. Okay. So, in order to extract the momentum of a quantum mechanical particle, you introduce an operator, and this is called the momentum operator. Now, in 1926, Erwin Schrödinger somehow put together all the information that was around and very confusing at the time, and understood how to conceptually unify all of that information. So, what you would like to do is to do the following. You would like to understand how to describe the quantum or the dynamics of, say, an electron. So what you would do is you introduce a function which describes the electron somehow. Now, what does it do? It takes plane waves, and for the plane wave k, you just declare that the corresponding amplitude, so how much plane wave do you have at k? Well, so much. This is just the amplitude for the plane wave at value k. And then you integrate over all values of k. Okay? So you would understand a function of this form. So this is the wave function. And the question is, how does this evolve in time? And Schrödinger, well, I don't really have time to do that, but if you consider the action, then you consider pairs of variables whose product has the physical unit of action. So x and p. X multiplied with P has the unit of action. And energy and time multiplied have the unit of action. So there are the so-called Hamilton-Jacobi equations, which relate the change of X and the change of P with respect to the derivative of the action with respect to the corresponding conjugate variable. Now, the conjugate variable to the Hamiltonian or to the energy operator is the time. Okay, so therefore it makes sense to consider time derivative, and what Schrödinger did was to make this time derivative in such a way, or to add something to the time derivative in such a way, that this has the unit of energy. So you see, this is an action, this is 1 divided by time, so this is energy. Psi is, now you take the Hamilton function and you replace the momentum with the momentum operator here. And then this turns it into a differential operator and you apply it to the function psi, and this is your well-known Schrödinger equation. And this is, of course, a partial differential equation, and what you need to analyze it are, for instance, functional analysis, harmonic analysis, and theory of dispersive PDEs. Okay. Now, of course, while classical mechanics was discovered first, quantum mechanics is the more fundamental theory, and actually there should only be one theory, right? So you should be able to actually just start with quantum mechanics and be able to derive everything that classical mechanics is telling you. And, well, how would you look at that? So first of all, the interpretation of this function here, psi, is that rho of t and x, which is the absolute value of psi of t and x square, is the probability that the particle is at x at time t. Okay? And usually this is normalized in such a way that the rho is a probability measure. Okay? Now, as a remark, if you start with this, right? So psi absolute value square integrated over x is 1. Okay? Now you can take, say, why not? 1 over x times x psi square. Nothing has happened. Now you can use Cauchy-Schwarz. So this gives you x square psi square 1/2 1 over x square psi square 1/2. Now you can use another inequality from real analysis, which is called the Hardy inequality, and apply it to the second guy there. And the Hardy inequality tells you that this is bounded by gradient psi square 1/2. But if you write this out, then using partial integration, you see that this is nothing else but psi minus Laplace psi. Okay? And this inequality is known as the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So Heisenberg uncertainty principle is not a physical law that Mr. Heisenberg discovered. It follows from actually harmonic analysis. Okay. Now, what can you tell about observations that you would like to make on these quantum mechanical systems? Well, usually what you would like to do is you want to understand what expectation values are of operators with which you act on psi. Right? So let's say you consider an operator A. So for an example, it could be a multiplication operator. So A sub f is just f multiplied with psi at x. Or it could be a differential operator, so AF is gradient psi, APSI is gradient psi of x, and so on and so forth. Okay, and the expectation of an operator in psi is defined as psi bar of x, I'm just suppressing the t here, a c of x dx. Right? So this is the definition of expectation of an operator. Now, some obvious operators that could come to mind to look at as examples would, for instance, be derivative operators. Well, you could put in here a derivative and maybe minus I h bar. What you would get is the expected momentum. Right? Or you could also take e to the I x c. Let's see what happens if we take the expectation of the plane wave, which you would, you know, associate with taking a Fourier transform. What would you get then? Well, here you get e to the I x c, absolute value of c of x squared dx, right? So this is just the Fourier transform of the probability density rho of x. Okay. Now, what would you get if you took the plane wave not in the classical momentum space, but in quantum mechanical momentum space? So let's say eta times the quantum mechanical momentum operator. So the quantum mechanical momentum operator is this here. Well, you know that in frequency space, the quantum mechanic, the partial derivative is a multiplication operator with the frequency. Okay? And, well, what you get then is e to the... Let me drop the h-bar for the moment because it makes it complicated. So you get e to the I eta... small p, this is just a number, c hat of p squared dp. Okay, so you get the Fourier transform of the probability distribution of c, but in frequency space. Okay, now something else that you can do only for the quantum system, but not for the classical system, is to look at the following. You can combine the two. So e to the I x c plus eta. Now let me take the quantum mechanical momentum operator c. Okay, this gives you something. This gives you a mixture between the Fourier transform, the classical probability distribution in x space and in p space. But somehow, because the x and the momentum operator don't commute, it's not entirely clear how momentum and x are related to each other. Okay, this, let me call it w hat of c and eta. Now I can re-express this w hat of c and eta in terms of x and p by taking an inverse Fourier transform. So let me call w of x and p is the inverse Fourier transform of this with respect to x and eta, e to the I cx plus eta. Now the small p is just a number, dx the eta. All right, so I get this quantity. And actually, if you look at it, you have to, you know, do some calculations, but you can actually verify that you can write it as follows. You can write it as follows. It's c of x minus y halves, c of x plus y halves, bar exponential I p y dy. Okay? After doing all of this acrobatics, take this expectation value, you get this, and then you take inverse Fourier transform, then you get that. This is called the Wigner transform. Of C. Okay? And the Wigner transform is one of the key tools to to derive classical physics from quantum physics. The way it works is as follows in the given example. So, you see, the link... So what is quantum mechanics? Quantum mechanics is the physical law that governs the dynamics of particles or systems, given that the classical action that you compute on it is comparable in size to h bar. Okay? Now, the question, of course, is, if you have classical action that is much larger than h bar, what happens? So, you can reformulate this question into formally letting h bar go to zero. Now, if we do that here, so we have to look at a Wigner transform that depends on h bar for a psi which solves the Schrödinger equation. So, where psi satisfies I h bar dt is h bar square minus 2m Laplace, so this is Laplace, plus u of x times psi, right? So you consider a rescaled version of this, and let me just write it here. The rescaled version of it, you have to do it right, and you have to rescale the variables, but what comes out in the end is that you obtain an h bar in here. Okay. Now, if you do that, then you might want to consider the dynamical equations that are satisfied by the Wigner transform when h bar goes to zero. Okay. And let's perhaps quickly have a look at what this might look like. So if you take a time derivative, then you use the product rule, so you have dt psi bar psi plus psi bar dt psi d to the I py dy, and here you can insert the Schrödinger equation. Right? Now, if you insert the Schrödinger equation, then on the right hand side, there is, oh, I just wiped it out, so I h bar psi is minus h bar square 2m Laplace psi plus u psi, right? So there are two terms. One term has the Laplacian, the other term has the potential term. Now, if you evaluate it, then what you get has the following form. From the terms that you combine that involve the derivative here, you get P dot gradient x of W h bar of t x p. If you take a derivative here, don't forget you have an I here, you have to divide by the I, and you have to divide by the h bar. And then you have Laplace here, but because you have a complex conjugate, you get actually negative 1 over I times Laplace, and here a plus, and then you combine them, and in the end you get this. It's just a calculation you have to do. The second term involves the U, and looks like this. It's I over H bar integral U of X plus h bar y, right? Halves, right? Because you have to evaluate the u at the place where the psi is evaluated, respectively the psi bar and the psi. And minus u of x minus h bar y halves. And here you have to copy over the expression that we'll have from here. So psi bar of x minus h bar y halves c x plus h bar y halves, and then in the end you have the I y p d y. Okay. Now you see here, when the h bar is small, together with the 1 over h bar, you have a derivative of u times y. So together with the 1 over h bar, this here goes to gradient in x u at x dot y. Right? Now, the y here combined with the exponential iyp and the I over here is the iy, exponential ipy, is nothing else but the gradient in p, e to the ipy. Right? But the only function that depends on p in here is the exponential here. So you can take the gradient out. So all of that there is p dot gradient x w h bar of the d minus gradient. And you see, when h bar goes to 0, this becomes just gradient of u at x. So it does not depend on y any longer. So you can also take it out of the integral. So this is gradient in x, u of x dot gradient in p, integral of what's in here. But this is nothing else but the Wiegler transform. Okay? So when h goes to 0, and you say that w tends to, say, call it mu, then as h bar goes to 0, the dt in w tends to dt of mu. And on the right-hand side, the p dot gradient x of w h bar tends to mu. And tends to, I mean, of course, you have to make it rigorous. It's not actually this straightforward, but you have to take a weak limit and all that. But philosophically, this is what you get. Okay? And now you can put the right hand side to the left hand side. Right? And what you recover is what? That's the classical Liouville equation. So, in this way, the classical Hamiltonian dynamics on as the dynamics of a probability distribution on phase space is recovered from taking the Fourier the Wiegler transform of a solution to the Schrödinger equation and letting h bar go to 0. Okay? Now, so now there is a much bigger picture to this. So what you can do is the following. Let me just try to. So here we have looked at quantum mechanics, and we have looked at classical mechanics, and we have gone from here to here by taking h bar go to 0. Okay. Now, the quantum mechanics that we looked at was for one particle. But of course, you can look at two particles, you can look at 10 particles, you can look at 10 to the 20 particles. And if you take infinitely many particles, well, what would you do? If you take n particles, then you would look at a wave function that depends on x1 up to xn. Right? So that would be a function, say, in L2, because we assume that this is a probability distribution, so it has to be square integrable in Rn, but actually capital N copies, so R times N times N. Okay? And if you assume that you want to admit the possibility that your system can have unboundedly many particles, then let me call it sub n, then you can take the direct sum of all such spaces where n ranges from 0 particles to infinitely many particles, And this is called the particle Fock space. And for particles, for systems where the particle number is not bounded, you write down the Schrödinger equation on the Fock space. And you can do that just the way we did previously in components, or there is actually a very nice bookkeeping device which is called, which uses the notions of creation and annihilation operators, and you can there use that in order to reduce the notation for the Hamiltonians drastically. Okay, but basically still that theory is a Schrödinger equation on this different space here. Okay, now that would be over here, and a theory that uses that is called the field theory. Now. In a quantum field theory, you can have infinitely many particles, but you can also have finitely many particles. Right? You can assume, you can tune your system in such a way that the expected number of particles is n. Okay? And now, you can obtain. So you see here the classical mechanics and linear quantum mechanics were related. Now here you have many particles, and the quantum field theory also depends on H bar. And so this describes to you a system of many, many particles. But in a system of many, many particles, you could ask, if you give one particle, then on the average, what kind of dynamics does it exhibit when you take the average over all interactions from the other particles? Now, to understand that, you would take a combined limit where h bar goes to zero and n goes to infinity in a controlled way, where one balances the other in a diagonal limit. And in such a limit, what you can obtain are nonlinear Schrödinger equations. You can obtain Vlasov equations from fluid dynamics or plasma physics. So from here to here, you just go from n is equal to 1 to n is much bigger than 1. Yeah, I should also say that if you keep the H bar intact, but in an appropriate quantum theory, you take the n going to infinity, and you let zero in a controlled way. So n goes to infinity, but the coupling constant goes to zero. You can obtain classical field theories, for instance, Maxwell equations. So using combined limits of particle numbers, interaction strength, and H bar, you can obtain classical field theories from quantum mechanics and quantum field theory.
Is there an action that takes out wave functions in quantum mechanics that solve the Schrödinger equation as a minimizable action?
Is
there an action?
So you can perhaps understand it in the following way. Right. So you want to solve the Schrödinger equation. The Schrödinger equation gives you a solution psi of t and x, and given initial data psi at zero and x. Well, I mean not the same x, but so this map here is given by the given to you by the solution by the flow of the Schrödinger, generated by the Schrödinger equation. Now, say you want to understand if this is psi and this is psi naught. You evaluate psi naught at the point y, and you evaluate psi of t at the point x. Then, of course, you could think of a classical path that connects x with y and which solves the classical Hamilton's equation or Newton equations, and that classical path would minimize the action. Right? Now, the Schrödinger equation, what does it tell you? It gives you the perturbation, and this is going to be rigorous if you let h bar go to zero. If h bar goes to zero and you consider the solution to the Schrödinger equation, then what will come out will be exactly the content of the wave equation that depends only on the classical path. But if h bar is positive, is non-zero, what you get is a perturbation of the around the classical trajectory of order h bar. So this is what the solution to the Schrödinger equation is going to give you. So this is not going to be related to the minimizer directly of the action functional, but it is related to the next order correction to the action of the function action functional with respect to perturbations of order h bar. This is the content of the path integral formalism.
Do all of these results still hold true for potential functions that depend on the momentum of the particle?
So you're looking at pseudo-differential operators then. In a vague sense, yes. Right? So what you're doing here is you're representing the solution to a linear PDE using stationary phase estimates. This is because you can write this in path space as something that looks like e to the I function. Well, I shouldn't say phi. So say f of x and g of x. If you look at integrals of this sort, then the dominant part of this integral comes from where gradient f is zero. And this is what's happening over here when you evaluate the Schrödinger equation in this space of paths. Now, if you assume that your operator is more general than that, it's not minus Laplace plus u, but is some pseudo-differential operator, it will depend on the operator, but if it is not too far away from this, then a stationary phase analysis will likely give you a similar result.
Could you also build the relativistic equations, like general relativity, from the same analysis?
The only quantum the only quantized theory that incorporates general relativity to some degree, you know, is string theory, and over there you have to ask string theorists if they can do it.